Tam. Upon him. Eva. Certainly. Jayati. Meditating. Devam. Divine. Apachyam. Son. Kapilam. Lord Kapila. Harim. The Supreme Personality of Godhead. Babhuva. Became. Achirataha. Very soon. Vatsa. O dear Vidura. Nispraha. Unattached. Tadrishe grahe. To such a home. Translation, O Vidura. Thus always meditating upon her son, the Supreme Personality of Godhead Kapila Deva, she very soon became unattached to her nicely decorated home. So you can repeat. O Vidura. Thus always meditating upon her son. The Supreme Personality of Godhead Kapila Deva. She very soon became unattached to her nicely decorated home. So purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, ki jai. Here is a practical example of how one can elevate oneself in spiritual advancement by Krishna consciousness. Kapila Deva is Krishna, and he appeared as the son of Devahuti. After Kapila Deva left home, Devahuti was absorbed in thought of him, and thus she was always Krishna conscious. Her constant situation in Krishna consciousness enabled her to be detached from hearth and home. Unless we are able to transfer our attachment to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there is no possibility of becoming freed from material attachment. The Srimad Bhagavatam, therefore, confirms that it is not possible for one to become liberated by cultivation of empiric philosophical speculation. Simply knowing that one is not matter but spirit soul, or Brahman, does not purify one's intelligence. Even if the impersonalist reaches the highest platform of spiritual realization, he falls down again to material attachment because of not being situated in the transcendental loving service of the Supreme Lord. The devotees adopt the devotional processes, hearing about the Supreme Lord's pastimes and glorifying his activities, and thereby always remembering his beautiful eternal form. By rendering service, becoming his friend or his servant, and offering him everything that one possesses, one is able to enter into the kingdom of God. As it is stated in Bhagavad Gita, Tato mam tatvato gyatva, after discharging pure devotional service, one can understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead in fact, and thus one becomes eligible to enter into his association in one of the spiritual planets. So, tameva dhyayati devam apachyam kapilam harim bhavuva charito vatsa nispriha tadrishe grihe. So Umaganat Midanda Shaganjana Shlakaya Chakshur Miditam Yena Tosmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So I think in this class we'll do something a little interesting. We'll talk about Hegel. Oh my God, what am I talking about Hegel for? So Hegel is an interesting person. I'm gonna relate it to the Bhagavatam verse, obviously. I'm not that crazy. So Hegel was a very interesting personality, and he was one of the preceptors of Marx, not the Marx brothers, like Groucho and Harpo, but he was, you probably remember them, I do. So, but he came up with this understanding of how things progress within this world. He talked about, you know, there was a thesis, antithesis, and a synthesis. I don't know if you remember this. Anyway, so what's being presented here in this verse and in religion in general is something like that. Like like, for example, religion actually has these three different aspects. Bhagavad Gita presents these three different aspects, thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And it's very interesting. So anyway, so let's analyze this, because we understand Devahuti had a very opulent life, right? I mean, her husband, Kardama Muni, he was actually quite a good yogi. He was able to create all these palaces and servants and everything like that. So generally, people consider that to be the goal of religion, you know, to have an opulent life, or to actually prepare your opulent life in the next life. Just like the hippies, they're, anyway, when we were young, their goal or their concentration was on sex, drugs, and rock and roll, right? Everybody remembers that? Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So religion, most religion is performed for that particular purpose. Now, what do I mean by that? That appears like a crazy statement. Let's take the Vedic religion, for example, where you go to the heavenly planets. What do you get there? Sex, drugs, you know, somaras. You know, we're not talking about, you know, hashish or something like that, or heroin, and music. Isn't it? You got the musicians, Gandharvas. I mean, I know it's not like Janis Joplin or people like that. You know, obviously, you know, she's not there. Nor is that, who is that personality who put himself in the universal form? Jimi Hendrix is certainly not there. You know, he's probably in the opposite place, because he actually tried to portray himself or put his face in the universal form. It's actually interesting. Who's that? Also, some big movie star also did the same thing. Anyway, so the point is that that's generally the aspiration for religion, isn't it? I mean, just like you see, you know, Christian religion too. You know, it's heaven based, right? Don't you want to go to heaven? And in the Vedic culture, don't you also want to go to heaven? And in the Muslim culture, don't you also want to go to heaven and get nice virgins there are going to be ready for you, isn't it? So that's generally, you know, what people perceive as religion. And of course, let's get back to the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita, of course, presents some, in the beginning, in order to get Arjuna to fight, also there's some encouragement for some material sense gratification, like, you know, you're going to, you know, for one who is honored, dishonor is worse than death. You know, so in other words, there's some material allurement there that Krishna's presenting to him, you know, even in the beginning, you know, this. I'm not saying that that's the goal of Bhagavad Gita, but that's actually some presentation there. So anyway, so that appears to be mainly the goal of religion, you know, in the material world, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You can actually remember that when you're preaching to people. If someone asks you to do an interreligious comparison, you can actually present it on the basis of this. What we're actually going to do is karma, jnana, and bhakti. Anyway, just to put it in some Vedic nomenclature. So you can explain to people like that. You know, we can examine a religion not based upon what culture it comes from, whether it comes from India, whether it comes from, you know, the West, or whether it comes from here, but basically whether the religion is focused on karma, jnana, or bhakti. See, it's very interesting. You know, when people want to have interreligious dialogues, they usually talk about, you know, what rituals you do. Well, we chant the Lord's holy names on beads. Well, we chant the Lord's holy names in kirtan. Well, we don't chant the whole Lord's holy names. You know, we have this ceremony where we walk around with the Torah, you know, it's called Sinkas Torah in the Jewish religion. I don't know if anyone's heard of it. Anyway, they once a year they actually parade the Shastras around. And also in the, in different religion, what was that? Oh, the Sikhs also. They actually have their main literature, and they worship it like the deity. They wake it up in the morning. Did you know that? They wake it up in the morning, put it to sleep at night, do an RT to it. So all these different, like, external things are there in every religion. And generally, when you're talking about interreligious, you know, with interreligious dialogue, you talk about the external things. You know, the rituals. The rituals, what time you get up, you know, this is your spiritual dress, you know, dhoti, sari, or a burqa. You know what a burqa is? Burqa is like the Muslim, what many of the Muslims wear, where the ladies get a peephole. They get to look out, you know. It's like, you're going to be frightened just to see someone's eyes staring out at you from a piece of cloth. So anyway, so generally, that's what people do when they do interreligious dialogue, you know. Just, but they don't really get back to down to the essence, you know, whether it's karmagana. And so by karma, of course, we mean not just karmic reactions, but just the desire to enjoy the material world. And of course, in the Vedic context, it gets to the extent of what we call karma kanja rituals, that is, for material upliftment. Or even, let's say even more refined, is the karma mimamsa philosophy. Yeah, it's called purva mimamsa. In which the karma mimamsa philosophy, of course, that's Jaimini's philosophy, is if you act nicely, you'll get a good result, and it doesn't matter. You know, God becomes actually subservient. God actually becomes subservient to your actions. And generally, it's also very interesting, also in Christianity, they've taken up this particular understanding, and to a certain extent. Because at least the Christian theologians, I'm not talking about what's being presented generally, is because Christianity, Jesus Christ preached bhakti, but he didn't give much like theoretical or philosophical knowledge. So therefore, they had to get their philosophical knowledge from the Greeks. They couldn't get it from him, you know, because he didn't present much of it. And so it's mostly like the early Christianity is Greek theology, or Greek philosophy, not theology specifically, which is, yeah, anyway, it's quite interesting. It's quite interesting. There's some karma. There's actually a lot of karma mimamsa elements in Greek philosophy. Karma mimamsa, of course, is the philosophy that Krishna also spoke to Nanda Maharaj when he wanted to convince Nanda Maharaj not to worship Indra. He said that even if there is an Indra, and we're not exactly sure if Indra does exist, because he was trying to aggravate Indra. So even if there is an Indra, still, you know, if we act nicely and do our duty, you know, he's bound to, you know, give us good results. And so generally, this is the understanding. Of course, in many of the Vedic literatures, this can be interpreted from different statements. I mean, for example, the demigods seem to be, in many cases, dependent upon the earthlings offering sacrifice. And, you know, sometimes you even find statements in the Mahabharata, for example, where earthlings offer too much sacrifice and the demigods get sick because they're offering so much ghee in the fire to Agni that, you know, Agni has to just like, what was it, like for 12 or 14 years he was just drinking ghee. And then Agni has to devour the Kandava Pras forest just to get rid of his indigestion. You know, the herbal remedies, you know, he couldn't get the Amazon herbs. So he had to get the Kandava forest herbs, and that he had to get the whole thing. So you'll find, generally, you can analyze religions according to this particular distinction, karma, jnana, or bhakti. I mean, that's a really, like, a common denominator way of analyzing every single religious process. So after karma, that is the desire to enjoy this world, comes jnana. And Prabhupada mentioned this in the second verse here. Prabhupada says, therefore, it is the Srimad Bhagavatam confirms that it is not possible for one to become liberated by cultivation of empiric philosophical speculation. That's what jnana means. That by cultivating, it's a reaction, in one sense, the jnana is a reaction, or the desire to become liberated, is a reaction to the karma. Because as Krishna also presents this in the Bhagavad Gita, too. What does he say? He says, Brahma bhuvana loka punavartino arjuna mamu pechu dukantiya punarvajanmana vijitai, doesn't he? He says, from the highest planet to the lowest planet, they're all places of misery. So Arjuna, you better get the hell out of there. So, you know, as an impetus, he presents that. So that's the second stage, you know. And jnana is actually, or the desire for liberation, or the negation of the material world, or the understanding the material world is misery, is actually the antithesis of karma. Everyone understands antithesis? You know, it's a reaction, the opposite. Karma is the desire to enjoy. It's just like you have the stages of human life, the purusharthas. Dharma, artha, kama, moksha. You got those last two. Everybody understands that? Dharma means, you know, all the rituals. Dharma, artha means economic development, so you can do what you want. We got to make some money. And then kama means to enjoy. And as a reaction, the antithesis of karma is moksha or liberation. So actually, we're just drawing from different sources to try to understand these paradigms. So anyway, so the antithesis of the desire to enjoy is the desire to get liberated. And you see this in human culture too. It goes in cycles. Whether we're talking about Western religion or Eastern religion, I mean, Eastern religion, you have the karma, kanja section, and then there's a reaction to that. As we mentioned yesterday, you have the aranyakas, that means the forest, you know, the forest scriptures who deal with people who renounce everything or trying to become free from this material world, or the Buddhists, they're a reaction. You understand? The Buddhism and the Jainism is a reaction to the desire to people trying to enjoy the material world. So it's interesting. You have this antithesis, which is a reaction. So we're talking about Hegel. Hegel's three things, you know, thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. So then, in the Bhagavad Gita, actually, Krishna presents the synthesis, ultimately, is, you know, manmana bhavamad bhakto mad yajimam namaskuru. Offer your obeisances to me, thus you will come to me. Offer everything with love and devotion. I mean, in many places, there's the synthesis in the Bhagavad Gita. Patram pushpam palam toyam. Yome bhakta prayachati. So this synthesis between karma and jnana gives one, as Prabhupada states here, the renunciation from this material world, whereas jnana itself doesn't give you renunciation, nor does karma give you pleasure, which is quite interesting. You know, there's the concept that karma, you know, the desire to enjoy, the attempt to enjoy, either in a Vedic context or in a non-Vedic context, will give you happiness, but it doesn't. And there's the concept that jnana will actually free you from distress, but it doesn't. Whereas bhakti is able to accomplish that. And of course, that's Rupa Goswami's, you know, nutshell verse of the whole nectar of devotion, bhakti rasam rita sindhu, anyabhi lashita shunya, yana karma avatam, anukulayena krishnana shilanam bhakti rutamam, isn't it? He said, this devotional service is devoid of karma and devoid of jnana. The desire for liberation is desire to enjoy this material world, but is simply in the positive quality, the desire to serve Krishna in an active fashion according to what he wants with a sense of devotion to three qualities. And we've mentioned this verse many, many times before. So, of course, we may be in another stage right now. We may be trying to do devotional service for enjoyment, you know, karma, or liberation. I remember when I joined the movement, I was actually, you know, very much on the jnana platform. I was attempting to chant to get out of this material world, and I've told this story before. I was asking Krishna to kill me. I mean, every night I, you know, like the Christians, they pray, you know, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. I said, I pray the Lord my soul to take. You know, and not if I die before. I didn't say if I die before I wake. I said, let me die before I wake. So a little changing, you know, that prayer, that, you know, the Christian prayer? Yeah. So I was actually changed it, you know, please let me die before I wake because this material world is miserable. Get me out of here. But there's nothing wrong with that. Because as Krishna also says in Bhagavad Gita, what? Chaturvidha bhajanti mam. The people come to him for those reasons, right? Krishna, it's interesting. Krishna actually says, people come to me for jnana and karma. What do you say? People come to me because they're looking for wealth. That's artha, which leads to kama, you know, but that's a desire for kama. People come to me because they're in distress. That's jnana, right? And people come because they're inquisitive. That's also a mixture of artha. That's a mixture of karma and jnana. People come because they're looking for knowledge. That's a little higher, but they're still looking for knowledge. It's not quite bhakti at that point. So Krishna understands that, and we also should be a little introspective to understand that, you know, we have different elements of this that are, encouraging us in devotional service. You know, we may want to get liberated from the material world. We may want to enjoy the material world. We even, like Prabhupada even one time said, you know, that some of the devotees will go to the heavenly planets. So we may actually want to even go to the heavenly planets. Or we may even have a conception of the spiritual world that is similar to the heavenly planets where we get to enjoy there. You understand? So that of course, tends towards sahajism, where one actually, and that, you know, it's interesting that people have this enjoying propensity in relationship to Krishna. And there's nothing wrong with that, as I said before. It's a stage. We shouldn't, like, heavy someone out for that. No, you're just interested in karma, jnana. We should see that, you know, they're progressing. At least, as Krishna says in the Bhagavatam, akama sarva karma, moksha kama daradi tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. Isn't it? He says, whether one is desirous, akama, I was free of lust or free of desire to enjoy this material world, sarvakama, he said, even if one has all desires, in other words, one wants sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I like that statement, isn't it? If you actually think about it, that's what's going on in the heavenly planets. I mean, that's what I meant, isn't it? It is. I'm sorry. That's all that's going on in the heavenly planets. And, you know, there's devotion to Krishna, too. I mean, it's mixed. It's a mixed bag. But, you know, that's... I'm Indra, you know, and you have those dancing girls like Urvasi, and Krishna even provided Urvasi to them. It came from Narayan Rishi. So, anyway, so akama, that means without material desire. Sarvakama, one has all material desires. In other words, wants to go for sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Actually, we should present that to the devotees who want to hit the nightclubs at night. That we have a better version of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, the heavenly planets. Actually, it's true. I mean, sometimes we have one of our devotees doing Sankirtan in Franklin Street in the evening, and they run into the devotees who want to hit the clubs. Anyway, so we should say there's something better than this, at least, heavenly planets. But actually, even better than that is spirit. So what Krishna says, akama, sarvakama, even if one is full of material desire, or all material desires, the word sarva means all. It's pretty interesting, isn't it? Sarva, that means really wanting heavenly enjoyment. Sarva karma, or moksha karma, there's jnana there. See, those three elements are also in that verse. Think about it, it's interesting, is it? Isn't it? I mean, how you find these three elements pervading our philosophy, and also pervading all religions, and pervading, you know, practically all of life, that is karma, jnana, and bhakti. So there's those three elements there. Akama, that's bhakti, it means no material desires. You know, just like mama janmani, janmani sure, bhavatad bhakti ahoy tiki tvaye. And then you have sarva karma, all material desires. And then moksha karma, which is jnana or liberation. See? Interesting. So whether one wants any of these three things, Krishna says, go for it by worshiping me. He says, tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. Just worship me very enthusiastically. So anyway, that's the point. So therefore, we should not decry other religions where karma is actually the focal point. At least they're worshiping God and will make spiritual progress. So of course, here... we're talking about Devahuti, who is certainly on the platform of bhakti. And therefore, she achieved happiness, she achieved liberation, and ultimately eternal service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead by meditating upon her son, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So any questions or comments about these points? Some interesting analyses. You know, just going back, it's just thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. Karma is the thesis, you know, the actual opposite or the reaction of that, which we see historically, the Buddhists, I'm just reiterating so, you know, in case people forget, which the Buddhists, the Jains, and other people did, or even the Aranyakas, the people went to the forest. Those are the scriptures. And then there's the reaction to that, and then there's finally the bhakti, which is the culmination or the synthesis of the two, in which you can achieve the goal of both, which is interesting. With bhakti, you achieve the goal of karma is actually to become happy. Ultimately, you know, if you analyze it, I mean, that's the reason for wanting to acquire more things in the world. That's the reason for wanting to enjoy sense objects. It's just to be happy. And what's the reason for jnan is to become liberated so you won't be miserable and ultimately will be happy. So you get that all with bhakti. Everything is gotten with bhakti. Shraddha Shabde Visha Sakahe Sudrida Nishchayat. Simply by performing bhakti, all the goals and everything is accomplished according to, that's faith, according to Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami and the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Any questions, comments, arguments about this? Yeah. Jnana, Buddhism? At least there's different types of Buddhism, you know? It's quite interesting. A lot of the Buddhism that's being presented today, and of course there's Theravada, Mahayana Buddhism, would actually have a lot of bhakti in it. You know, they're worshiping Lord Buddha. I mean, if you've ever been to Thailand, anyone here ever been to Thailand? They have this big Buddha, it's as big as practically a football field. You've been there, you've seen it? It's really, he's lying down, you know. And, oh, that's another one. Yeah, no, they have a sitting one that's his gold. And I was trying to figure out how to take him away, but anyway. You saw the gold one there? Pure gold.
Yeah, it's the place they call Indra Lok. Actually, it's very much mixed up with the Hindu
culture.
Appreciation.
Definitely. They have vending machines with incense in them on the corners. Yeah.
That's called the gate. If you ever go to Thailand, you go to the gate. Mm-hmm. You have a swing gate. It's like, I don't know, 77 stories in tall or something, too. But on the road going up there, it's just like incense shops, murti shops.
Mm-hmm.
It must be, you know, 50 or 100 of them or something. They sell you all kinds of
things. Yeah. No money, though.
Oh, you can make money in there.
Really?
Yeah.
I should try that. So, but it's interesting that sometimes when the religion starts off with the jnana aspect, which Buddhism definitely started off. I mean, Buddha's teaching. I mean, he didn't have much. Actually, he didn't teach ontology at all. You know, about the universe or anything like that. Or he just taught, you know, basically a psychology of becoming detached from this world. So it's interesting because people have a natural inclination towards bhakti. It actually transforms itself gradually. And this is what we see with Buddhism. That Buddhism, because, you know, most people are not armchair philosophers in the world. Most people have a heart. Most people. So the religion actually transforms sometime into it with many elements of bhakti. So they're worshiping Buddha. And then they invented all sorts of things like different Buddhas or different heavens you can go to that were not there in the original Buddha's teachings, which is really, you know, if you analyze the progress of the progressive Buddhism how it was presented from Theravada and Mahayana Buddhism. So yes, Buddhism is like original Buddhism is very much like Jnana, or the Jain religion. which is not followed by many people. There's a lot of jnana in there. I mean, a lot of desire for liberation in the Jain religion. And, you know, that was Mahavir and everything like that. And Prabhupada discusses that to a certain extent. So, you know, there are religions like that. But generally in the West, we find karma. You know, don't you want to go to heaven? Are you afraid of going to hell? And the Muslims particularly, it's a lot of karma stuff there in the Muslim religion that, you know, that you go back to heaven, you die in a war against the Hare Krishnas, and you get, like, all these virgins, you know, greeting you. And also, you know, like, even in the Bhagavad Gita, you'll find that in the beginning, you know, oh, you go to heaven, you go to heaven, and you also be greeted by all these nice little girls there. You know, you'll be, in the Mahabharata, at least, there's that inclination towards, karma, enjoyment. Like that. And that's one of the reasons why Śrīla Vyāsadeva was chastised by his spiritual master, Narada Muni, because he was encouraging people in karma. You know, really, heaven is just like really emphasized in the Mahabharata. Not so much devotion to Krishna, but heaven. You know, you go back to heaven. And even at the end of the Mahabharata, it's portrayed, you know, you have the Pandavas and the Kurus. I mean, of course, Yudhisthira has to undergo some tests before he goes to heaven. That's another part of the story. But then everybody's back in heaven and singing Kumbaya. Isn't it?
Yeah, Duryodhana
is there, yeah.
What's he doing?
What's he doing there? And you know, the brothers are in hell. He thinks the brothers are in hell. Anyway, there's a whole story about that. But ultimately, everybody's singing Kumbaya because Duryodhana is actually the worst of the demigods, Kali. He's an incarnation of that. So, and then you're in heaven. So there's a lot of emphasis, and Vyasadeva was chastised for that specific reason, because there's that impetus or the stress on karma there, rather than, you know, you find bhakti, but it's not really emphasized in the Mahabharata, at least the Mahabharata that we have. So generally, yeah, karma is very prominent nowadays. But, you know, you also see jnana a lot in India. Sometimes you have these renunciates who, like, torture their body and everything like that. They go to the Himalayas and engage in, like, severe austerities. I'm not sure exactly what the Nagababas believe in, but it's, you know, maybe someone has analyzed it. But you know, you find people who are engaged in, like, trying to get detached from the material world by executing austerities. I've even seen it in our movement, too. In the beginning days, I had friends who just did orange fast for a year to try to get rid of lust, and they ended up going crazy instead of getting rid of lust. But the point I'm making is that bhakti, the culmination of bhakti or devotion, accomplishes everything. And we find that in Devahuti's case. I mean, her bhakti for her son enabled her to become completely detached from this world. That's very hard, like for a mother, you know, living at home with an opulent life, completely detached. And so the bhakti, of course, according to Kapiladeva, is the transferring the attachment. It's a very easy process to transfer the attachment, the very same things, or that one was attached in the material world. If one focuses on spiritual objects instead, then, you know, the process of attachment is the same, but you just focus on different objects. In other words, instead of being attached to the enjoyment of society, friendship, and love, one becomes attached to the enjoyment of the spiritual society, friendship, and love. You know, Krishna's pastimes, the association of devotees. So the same attachment, when it's focused, properly focused, can lead to bhakti. And that's what we see in the case of Devahuti. The same attachment that a mother has for the child, she focuses on her child, who happens to be Krishna, of course, and she becomes detached from this material world. So that's our process. It's a very easy process. But even if one is not, even if you want to go to heaven, then just chant Hare Krishna. That's what Krishna says. But chant it forcefully, enthusiastically. And just like Dhruva Maharaj, what did he want? He had a desire for karma, right? That means material, opulence. He wanted to have a kingdom greater than that of his great-grandfather. And so he performed devotional service forcefully, enthusiastically, and what did he get? He got it, but actually at the end, you know, he wasn't so enthusiastic about it. He said, I'm looking for some valuable gems. And I was looking for some broken pieces of glass, and now I found a beautiful gem. That's from the Hari Bhakti Shudaya. So just be honest, you know, we have these desires, so let's perform bhakti. Whatever your desire is, in other words, perform bhakti. Bhakti, of course, means chanting, offering your food to Krishna, serving Krishna, like that. And you get happiness. That's the main thing. And, of course, you may still have anxiety, but that anxiety is actually ecstasy in Krishna consciousness. You may not understand that right now. Like Prabhupada said, one point said, we join the Krishna conscious movement, become free from anxiety. Now there's more anxiety. Because Prabhupada was undertaking all these projects, you know, like in Bombay and other places, the word causes of anxiety. But that anxiety is a symptom of, if you analyze the anxiety, what is it coming from? It's coming from your love for Krishna. And then you become very happy with that anxiety. Okay, all glorious through divine grace. Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, ki jai. Lord Kapila Dev, ki jai.